Melissa Kearney is a professor of economics at the University of Maryland. Melissa, thank you for taking some time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
So you sound fairly young. I don't know, but I grew up at a time where all we ever heard of was the population explosion. That phrase, the population explosion. Everybody was having too many kids, and the resources of the world were going to run out, and there were just too many people in the world. In fact, there were people who would deliberately not have kids because they didn't want to contribute to the problem. What happened?
Well, that was always that book, The Population Bomb, came out in 68. And, you know, that warning just was completely misguided, quite frankly. The idea behind that was we were going to have too many people. We couldn't feed them all. We couldn't take care of them all. And what that line of argument misses is that people actually are great at coming up with ideas and inventing things and making progress. And so at the same time as the global population grew, our standards of living also improved. And so the population bomb was a really a terrible warning. There's a lot of really ugly language in some of that writing too. And so, but it had a pretty lasting effect on thoughts. And so I think that's part of the reason why this idea that now our population is about to decline and that's going to bring about a whole bunch of challenges, I think it snuck up on some people, because that idea that, you know, population growth was a challenge really did persist for a long time.
Yeah. Mm. So what are some of the real serious ramifications of not enough babies in the world?
Well, can I start by just putting some numbers on it, what we're talking about? So the way demographers and economists talk about this is if on average a woman is not expected to have at least two kids over her lifetime, then the population of a particular country, or you know, now we're talking about the globe, just doesn't naturally reproduce. And so the global total fertility rate is approaching 2. In the U.S. we're already below population replacement fertility. We're at 1.6. We know in countries like South Korea or Japan, they're well below replacement level. So we see what's starting to happen in some of those countries. The first thing we see is the working age population starts to shrink. And having a smaller workforce is bad or challenging for a whole bunch of reasons. The most immediate is it puts pressure on social insurance systems. In the U.S., we can think about Social Security or Medicare. Those programs are supported by taxes paid by the working age population. So as soon as you start to have an aging population and fewer workers, then those fiscal systems, they're not fiscally sustainable. So that's an immediate challenge. You also start to worry about the implications for economic growth. Having fewer workers means less income overall, but worryingly, it also could mean less income per capita. And the reason relates back to something I said earlier. People are what, you know, it's people who come up with ideas and innovations and advances. And there's a real worry that when you have a smaller working age population, you have a less dynamic, innovative economy. And eventually what happens is living standards for everyone could decrease. Now, that doesn't have to happen, but we have to take very, very deliberate steps to prevent that from happening.
Are there any major powers in the world globally for whom this is not the case, that they're actually growing?
No. You know, China's already experiencing population decline. Almost all advanced economies are now at below replacement level fertility.
And why would you say
the only
that?
Large
why
area
would you
of
say
the world
that is? Why, it's not just because they all read that book. What's the biggest reason?
It's not. Yeah, so it really interestingly, if you look at advanced economies, high-income economies, Europe, Canada, the U.S., it's really interesting because it's like, you know, having kids has always been expensive and time-consuming, but it looks like more recent cohorts, generations of young adults, are choosing to have fewer kids. More of them are remaining childless. My read of the evidence, what I've concluded and I've written, is that it looks like people have shifted priorities. Basically, we see that, you know, having kids and expending all the time and energy and money on them comes into conflict with other goals, career goals, other ways you might want to spend your time, your leisure time. And people are resolving that by having fewer children. All things that make it harder to realize desired fertility, like delaying until it gets sort of biologically hard, that amplifies it. But I think it's really reflecting shifted priorities away from centering marriage and having kids as the defining characteristic of our adult lives.
Doesn't that go when you have to start, like you said, you really see houses with 10 kids like you used to see back in the day. And also, if you're doing like that many, you got to start earlier, like you're saying. You know, you can't start after grad school and college and 5 years working. You know, you got to start early to have those. Don't you think that part of the problem with what's going on now?
So women are definitely delaying childbearing. And in the U.S., we've seen birth rates fall steadily since 2007. People thought, oh, people were just delaying it till older ages, getting through the recession, waiting until they were more secure. But people just aren't catching up. And so, you know, well, teen childbearing is way down. I think that's a good thing. But, you know, all through the 20s, birth rates are down. The only groups of women in the U.S. that are having more births than they used to are in their late 30s or 40s. Now, if you start then, you're not going to be able to catch up to have 3, 4, or 5 kids biologically. But there's also something to be said for, well, part of the reason why people are waiting is because they don't expect to have that many or they don't desire to have that many.
Right. Mm-hmm. I wonder if the long-range, you know, economics people like yourself are sometimes in the business of projecting and looking ahead. Do people start to become a commodity that other nations start vying for? You know, I read these pieces about villages in Italy where they're giving away homes for a dollar because there's nobody living there anymore and they're trying to populate them. Ireland is another country that I've seen this where they put up these huge incentives for people to try to come move in there. And presumably you could do the same thing if you saw your population growth shrinking and you needed more people. And you didn't want to just open your borders necessarily. You could start in the the swiping left for population growth. Is that a possibility?
Well, immigration certainly is the most immediate way to sort of shore up the size of your working population or to bring in more kids. I mean, you know, the U.S. and others aren't necessarily rushing to change their immigration policies to bring in more people, but that is an immediate reaction or an immediate policy response. Of course, as the global population eventually starts to shrink, which projections have happening, you know, in the next 50 to 60 years, there are fewer countries to be sending immigrants to the you know, other economies. That's one thing. I mean, we also see a lot of countries now experimenting with explicit pronatalist plans, not just the move here and get a house, but if you have a third kid in Hungary, you will not pay income taxes. You know, South Korea just proposed paying the equivalent of what would be $70,000 to someone for having a child. A lot of European countries, which have had below replacement level fertility rates now for a couple decades, you know, are offering explicit tax credits. They don't do that much. This is the problem. It might get some women to, you know, speed up when they have a kid, but we really haven't seen any of these programs in other countries lead to a sizable, sustained increase in birth rates. So it's going to be hard for governments to really turn this around.
Yeah, well, and in the U.S., it's 1.6. That's what you're saying is now the average
person that's
has right, 1.6 which is, children. Wow.
Yeah. Now, we had, you know, in the U.S., throughout the 80s, 90s, early 2000s, we had a total fertility rate of above 2, which put us at a higher fertility rate than in European countries, which is a bit surprising because, you know, those countries have much more social support. They have more subsidized childcare, things that you'd think would make it easier for people to have kids. American women were still having more kids for a long time, but that seems to have changed. And now our fertility rate has converged downward to other high income countries.
So interesting. Melissa, thank you for coming on with us. This is really interesting stuff. Professor Melissa Kearney from the University of Maryland has been our guest. Appreciate it.
Thanks again for having me.
Better get Tyreek Hill on the phone.
WJR. Mm-hmm.